call this Legislative Commission on Data Practices. Data Practices to order. Today is Sunday, or excuse Sunday. Shooting for the weekend here. It is September 17th, 2015, 2:20. We're in room 200 of the State Office Building. Members, you have an agenda in front of you. We'll get through a couple of items, the call to order, which we've done, approving the minutes, and then we need to elect officers, chair and vice chair for the commission, and then we'll move on with our discussion items. So with that, hopefully someone has reviewed the minutes and is prepared to tell us that they are accurate and thorough and would like to move our adoption.
So move, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Lesh has done his homework. I'm impressed. All in favor of adopting the minutes from Monday, December 22nd, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Next, we elect chair and vice chair for the commission, and I understand that the gavel, the chair, would come from the Senate. This year it's on a one-year basis, right? One-year rotating basis. Last year was Representative Holberg from the House. This year will be a Senate chair, and then the vice chair will be a House member. I don't think that's actually written down anywhere, but that's the understanding. So, and that would be fair. And we're all about being fair and cross-chamber and cross-party cooperation in this, because we all get along here. We model for the rest of the legislature. So with that, folks might be surprised. I'm actually probably not interested in having my name placed in nomination as chair. Senator Kent is. So I would like to place Senator Kent's name in nomination to be chair. Would you like to give a rousing campaign speech? No. We don't have anyone else from the Senate to object. I think we all vote total, so y'all can shoot this one down if you want, I guess. Do we take them both at the same time or one at a time? All right, why don't we vote on that? All in favor of Susan Kent as chair of the Legislative Commission on Data Practices, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Would anyone's name like to be placed in nomination for the House?
You're into it? Okay, I nominate Representative Scott.
Okay, Representative Scott's name has been placed in nomination as vice chair, representing the House. Would anyone else's name like to be placed in nomination? Nominations are closed. All in favor of Representative Scott, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
You're supposed to vote for yourself and go like that.
I know. It seems kind of conceited. Also,
all right. Thank you, everybody. Looking forward to a productive session or interim of sessions to work on these issues. So picking up where we left off, I guess the next item is the legislative appropriation discussion. All right, Mr. Greg Hubinger, if he is here, if he would be willing to come speak with us.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Saw a quizzical look on Mr. Hubinger's face, so maybe I might suggest just tell us how much money we have and what can we spend it on. That's what this discussion is about.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. During the 15th session in the State Government Finance Appropriations Bill, the legislature appropriated $35,000 to the LCC for the current biennium, for the 16-17 biennium, to provide additional or support for the work of this commission. So it's one-time money for the next two-year period. The statute for the commission was modified slightly to indicate that staff support using these funds would be used for research support for the work of the commission.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions on that topic? Thank you, Mr. Huebinger. Yeah. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Huebinger, before you get up there, although you already have gotten up, so where does that, as far as research then, so we have Mr. Gehring here. So in the future, whoever that person is, that would be our go-to person then for most all the research, or how would that balance out with what Mr. Gehring does?
Mr. Huebinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the commission may decide how it wants to use the resources that are available to it. Mr. Gehring and then Ms. Pontius from Senate Council on Research have been providing ongoing research support to the work of the of this commission. The thought of staff might was that if this commission had specific topics that might be appropriate for a temporary employee that would be available to it for a couple of years to do that kind of specialized research that Mr. Gehring and Ms. Pontius don't have time for, that they could engage in that kind of work.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Huebinger. Next, I would direct the commission's attention to the topics to address. Senator Dibble.
I was wondering if we could just engage in a little bit of a discussion with the commission itself and try to figure out how to proceed on how to make a decision around how to use this appropriation.
How we use the appropriation?
Yeah, right. So I do know that we took a little survey last year. I don't know if anyone remembers having filled this out. That's this matrix that's in front of everyone that gives us some guidance on kind of what's topmost in people's minds. I know that Senator Limmer had some ideas, and so maybe I think he's intending to be here. Ms. Sobotka, do we know? Oh, he's not going to be here. Oh, that's too bad. So he had some ideas to undertake a little project. I think there's a little bit of a research element that was involved in that. Another idea that he had was to create a kind of a primer and a best practices guide for use by legislators and committees and committee chairs as they're drafting legislation that relates to data practices, a primer that kind of acquaints people with the basics of public data, private data, data security, et cetera, A. B, then this best practices guide, similar to something that Senator Rest had developed, and I'm not sure if it was ever adopted or taken up by the House, but kind of a best practices guide when establishing boards and task forces and commissions and work groups and things like that, so that folks are hitting all the right points and thinking about the right things when they're creating new policies and allocating resources that relate to data practices. I know Mr. Gemmerling has been in conversation with Senator Limmer about something, a project like that. It's hard to have this discussion in this forum and make a decision, but maybe a little working group or a subcommittee or some folks can go away and create a proposal to bring back to the next meeting. That's an idea that I have.
That is a good idea. Members have any additional thoughts on that topic?
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if I understand, and that's just in regard to like a best practices guide, or Senator Dibble, or is this globally entail more than that?
I was just mentioning that as illustrative of ideas that are out there for uses of the appropriation.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Is there interest in proceeding with a working group on that particular topic at this point, and we could begin that process before our next meeting?
Sure.
Obviously, we would probably want to loop Senator Limmer in, since this was something that he cared about a great deal. All right. Does anybody want to, at this point, sign or Senator Dibble?
I'm sure I'd be willing to help bring a proposal back to the next meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
And I would even offer to convene it.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Comments? Input? Anyone else want to work with Senator Dibble and Senator Limmer on this from the House? Representative Lesh?
If only to keep an eye on them.
Not a bad plan.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, with that, we will get that working group up and going.
So we'll, no one has to sign up today. We'll work with Ms. Sabatka, and I will work to let everyone know when we get together and all of that. So.
All right. Then, were there additional questions regarding the topics that had been reviewed before that we want to discuss at this point, or any thoughts about proceeding at this time? Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't remember filling this out, but I'm glad we have it compiled so we get a general sense of where folks are at on the committee. And I think it does generally follow the discussions that we've had previously on this commission as to what folks think are important. And I have questions, I think, about two different items. One being, I read something, it was either today or yesterday, about the MinCare situation. And there seemed to be some discrepancies in the data that was kept as part of the competitive bidding process with DHS. And I'd like to understand and have this commission review the DHS process and data storage process. And I don't know under which, I mean, obviously the health plan, healthcare data issues is one, but this is uniquely a government agency. So when we passed the Timberjay bill, which falls in the number four category, the recommendation on here, we wanted the health plan data. And that was due by, I think, was it June 30th? Okay, so that was due by June 30th. I haven't seen it. I was gone most of the summer. So I'm getting brought up to speed. So that's a question that I have. What happened to when we passed that bill in 2014? We made a compromise where they had to disclose. And I left for training this summer, so I was gone, and I was off the grid. I don't know what's going on. I come back, and I'm wondering if we got the health plan data. And I don't think we do.
That's a good question.
So I'm wondering what's going on with that. Second, there's this current issue with respect to the UCARE situation. And I know they're still negotiating and won't share information that's been requested by legislators, but I think we should have an opportunity to hear from Commissioner Jessen on this because it does tie in with the Timberjay bill that I have recurring questions about. The second issue I think that is uniquely pertinent in light of the most recent effort to sidestep the legislature with another data request on the part of law enforcement agencies, which I think was yesterday or the day before, wanting again to keep collection of data on private citizens secret. And it seems that we've run into this problem again and again and again. And maybe it shouldn't surprise me that some agencies have gone rogue and said we're going to sidestep the legislature again, but that's uniquely the province of this commission, I think, to talk about the direction we want to go on that. So I personally think that even though it's not on the agenda, those two specific items, I mean, they're pertinent right now, depending on when we have the next commission meeting, I think we ought to be on the same page.
Good.
So that's what I have to say about the topic areas, Madam Chair.
Good and topical points, Representative Lesch. Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Senator Dibble and I had gone back and forth a little bit in the last month or so on different topics, and maybe that's something that we can just bring you in and get you a copy of those emails or send you the email trail on that. But I know Representative Lucero had some ideas for topics, too. Going along with what Representative Lesch said, but there are some other topics out there that I think we need to look at. And I guess I would let him elaborate maybe on a couple of those that he had regarding local units of government and keeping their data secure and those sorts of things. And some of them that we talked about, Senator Dibble and I would probably fall under one of these categories, but I just wondered if Representative Lucero would maybe like to chime in.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't have my email immediately in front of me, so I'll have to pull that up. But you specifically the local units of government is my understanding of the question. Correct.
Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, yes. And then I believe you also there was something else that you brought up. Oh, the fiscal note that we got last year when we asked, I think it was DHS, to do some audit trails or some different things, and it was a $200 million fiscal note. And I think you had addressed that as well.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott and others. Okay, so the local units of government, just to give a brief idea of what I was thinking about there, is that when it comes to the, maybe I should start, for those who aren't aware, my background, what I do is computer security for a living. So this is a passion of mine, and I'm very interested. And so when I was a city council member and then operating more in the local units of government arena, you know, I always have my cybersecurity hat on, and everything I encounter, I'm always evaluating through that lens, whether or not I'm, quote-unquote, at work. And what became apparent to me readily quickly was there are, as we all know, a lot of very good and hardworking people at local units of government. However, due to the constraints, as well as the skill set of information security being in high demand, implementing information security practices, so policy standards and procedures, can be difficult. And so as I'm looking around and observing, I'm seeing very basic tenets of information security not being followed. And so I thought it would be a very good discussion for this commission to have if we want to have requirements, a baseline standard. You know, again, I'm not necessarily in favor of something from the state mandating what configurations have to be at the local level, but I think it's worthy of discussion if, you know, what should be done, because right now, what's a basic one? Basic configuration standard would be change your password a minimum every 90 days. Your password must be a minimum length of 8 characters, and it must have complexity, uppercase, lowercase, special character, and a number. That would just be one example. But there's a whole host of, you know, configurations that can be implemented. Another maybe basic example, there's something called the Microsoft Small Business Server. It was very common in 2003. I think they had one in 2008, but I can't remember. But the 2003 version was one where you take all of the different functions of servers and you put them into one server. And it's intended, just like the name suggests, a small business server, it's intended for those small businesses so that they can have a website, they can have a domain controller, and again, I don't want to get too technical, but just the different roles all wrapped into one. And I found that to be in use at the local level as well for the same reason, to have it all in one. Well, when you do that, you sacrifice, right? When you go easier for in one area, you sacrifice security, you give up something in another area, and that's what that does. So I found that to be in use at the local level. So that's just an example of some discussion that we could have. When it comes to the fiscal note, so you, Representative Scott, had a bill related, and I don't know entirely the contents of the bill, but along with your bill, a fiscal note came back, and your bill, as I remembered, at least a portion of it, was in relation to increasing the requirements of data log retention for auditing purposes. I think it was something to that effect. Well, the fiscal note, as you mentioned, came back at $200 million, and then when I examined the assumptions that were made, all activities, all events that happen within an IT infrastructure, whether it be on firewalls, whether it be on servers, whether it be on endpoints like telephones or mobile devices, I should say, laptops, etc., they are generating log, or typically almost all the technology has the ability to generate logs. The first question is logging enabled? If logging is enabled, what is the amount of time that they're being retained on each individual device?
And so for auditing purposes, logging has to be enabled for the activity that is already occurring. And then what is the retention period of those logs on each individual, what's called, event source? And there can be constraints such as the size of the disk. So hard drives have a finite amount of disk space. And if you don't put a limit on the amount of space that logs can chew up, can create havoc in your systems. And so the assumption in your note, the $200 million that came back, in order to enable logging and then to retain it, I think it was for 6 months or 12 months, something to that effect, the assumption they made was to increase the disk space on every server across the environment. And that is a preposterous idea because that is not what's done in the private sector. So enabling auditing and then retaining the records for auditing purposes is a very common practice in the sector that I operate in. And log retention isn't done that way. The way it's done is you set up another system that's dedicated for log collection and retention, and it is responsible for collecting the logs from each of the endpoints in one centralized place. And by doing that, you have a system that has enough disk capacity and the resources to be able to do that, and it's fractions less than $200 million. So you don't have to go around and up the disk space on each system. It's just that's a preposterous idea. So that's an example of where the fiscal note all depends on the assumption. The assumptions in that particular case were just one that most would disagree with. So that's what I was referring to there.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lucero. Additional discussion on that topic? I think you raise definitely some very good questions. And, you know, I was thinking, this topics to address analysis that we had looked at. Obviously, welcome, Representative Lucero. I guess we should have done that officially to the commission. But clearly, your input has been included in here. And things have happened on here since then. So, you know, I think it would be in order for us to figure out a way to sort of update and make sure we're current with where our priorities are as we move forward and integrate some of these new ideas, either that have come out from more recent events or people in their work in the past year, and make sure we're aiming in the right direction. Okay. All right. So any additional input at this time about topics? Otherwise, we will work on a process and come back to the commission with sort of next steps. Cool. Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more thing sort of popped into my mind, and I know a few years ago, I believe it was Senator Dibble and Mary Liz Holberg, after the data breach by the individual at the DNR, we addressed the consequences of someone that's an employee of government misusing data. And I believe it was just a couple weeks ago we had an instance where the driver's license, what am I trying to say? DPS, right? On the DPS website, there was something on there, on the website, on the page, that people were able to go in and find out driver's license information on private citizens. And so I think revisiting the topic of what are the consequences, whether someone intentionally or unintentionally allowed that to happen, to me it's unacceptable. And I, that whole system, we're way over budget on that. It's way behind schedule in coming to us. And then something as simple as that, to me, it's unexcusable. And so I'd like to revisit just, consequences of data breaches.
Okay. Adding that to the list.
All right. We great. Will. Thank you.
Representative Simonson.
Oops. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We'll get that fixed. But I just want to make sure that I add my comments to something that Representative Lesch brought up. And it has to do, I did receive a copy of a letter that was sent to Commissioner Jessen, and I see that a number of you, not all of you, but some of you were copied on this letter as well. And it's from the Greater Minnesota Healthcare Coalition. Mm-hmm. And it was it's dated August 4th, 2015, and it's talking about the letter from the Federal Trade Commission. And I'm just wondering if at a subsequent meeting, if we can get Perhaps an update from the commissioner in the form of a response to this letter in terms of, you know, what they're doing, and maybe then at that time we can kind of expand on it a little bit too. But I asked yesterday and there had been no response back to the coalition yet, so, and perhaps it's still being done, but I think it might be helpful at some point if we get the commissioner to come and just kind of talk about this and what's going on now that we've gone past June 30th, you know, what their position is perhaps. But if you can work that in, that would be great.
I made a note, Representative Black.
And Madam Chair, and I'd forgotten to follow up with Representative Hortman about this too, because I recall, I think it was Representative Hortman and Representative Hoppe who sent the letter to the FTC, right? And I saw Representative Hortman last night. I forgot to ask about it, but she wrote the letter to the FTC, and Representative Hortman was also the one who, on the floor, in the interest of extending it for a year, the data classification, made the argument that, well, let's hit the pause button for a year until we let the cat out of the bag. Maybe I'll just follow up with her afterwards, and maybe I can report back to the commission on what her idea was behind that.
Good. Great. Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Chair, one more thing.
No, let's put them all out.
Yeah, it has been, and I should have made a list. But one of the things that was supposed to happen before this meeting today was a hearing or a meeting on the Real ID. And I guess the folks coming from D.C., they were part of this. Evidently, American Airlines had some difficulties with their IT system, I guess, and so they weren't able to fly and get here. But that is an issue I think that we need to address, and if these enhanced driver's licenses are the things that are going to allow people to get on airplanes, then we need to have a game plan for that for the people of Minnesota.
Yep. Good point. In the news today. All right, so keep them coming. Everybody work on them, and we'll collect these and figure out a system by which we evaluate and sort of organize how we approach them in the coming months. So with that, thank you for that input. Moving ahead in the agenda, I believe we have someone from Minute here to talk about technology to ensure private, non-public data remains secure and private, a bit to Representative Lucero's concerns.
And Madam Chair, just
Senator Dibble.
Let you know it's kind of the Representative Lucero show today. I think the next three items are something knowledgeable about and quite interesting. So we have a minute here to provide us some information and some knowledge and some awareness, but also I think Representative Lucero is ready to speak on some of these as well.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairs. For the record, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota. I'd like to start off by just thanking you for giving me an opportunity to testify before you today. And I look forward to being a resource today and in the future if you have any issues about security and what's going on in the executive branch. I'm also excited. I had an opportunity to meet Representative Lucero already, and especially with the strong correlation between information security and privacy, I think it's tremendous that you have someone like that sitting on your committee today. In fact, he could probably do the presentation that I'm going to be giving today. So, for the record, I also prepared just a quick handout for people. I wanted to give people a high-level overview of the relationship between security and privacy and some of the things that we're doing in the state of Minnesota. And I thought by just organizing the thoughts on a handout, it would be more efficient for folks today. So just starting off, one of the things I wanted to mention out of the gate is that there's a lot of people that talk about when they talk about security and privacy, they talk about security and privacy being opposing forces. And that's not the way I look at the relationship between security and privacy. It certainly isn't a relationship where they're on opposite ends of the seesaw, and if you get more security, you have to give up privacy and vice versa. I don't think the relationship works that way. In fact, there's an adage in our industry that says you can have security without privacy, but you can't have privacy without security. That's why in the slides I put the privacy block on top of security, because unless we have a strong and robust security program, we can throw privacy out the window because people can get at the data that was supposed to be kept confidential. The reality that we know today is that when you look at security and privacy, government actually needs both. We need a strong security program to protect our systems and assets and make sure that the government services are available. However, we also have to make sure that we have privacy controls as well, and I think it's important for us as government, especially in our fiduciary capacity, to know that we have to be diligent to protect people's personal dignity when we gather lots of not public data about individuals. So to sum it up, security is an enabler of privacy. Moving on in my handout, one of the challenges that we're facing today is recognizing that security is an enabler of privacy. Security is harder than ever to get right. We're now in a world where we have more threats that face us on a day-to-day basis than we've ever had in the past. The threats are more targeted, and they're much more sophisticated. And one of the really good studies that I like to refer to is the Verizon Data Breach Report. If you look at the changing landscape, even in the 7 or 8 years that I've been serving as a state CISO, we now are in a world where most of the hacks that happen to data are executed by external perpetrators outside of our organization. We have situations today where if there's vulnerabilities in systems that become publicly known, they get exploited within minutes. And once people are in the systems, it's usually less than 24 hours before they can move around and attack other targets within systems as well. So it's a very different world than we've had in the past, but that's the challenge with information security. In fact, that's what makes it an exciting profession is that it's constantly changing. So with Minute Services, we recognize that we have to have a very robust security program for the state of Minnesota. And I put a slide together that kind of shows you how we define our security stack. So a lot of people think of security as a black box, so I thought I'd just take a minute to talk about really what do we see inside that black box. And in particular, addressing some of the issues of the committee today, what are those tools that we have at our disposal to make sure that the stuff that's supposed to be private actually remains private? So most of the services that we define in our security stack are there to prevent bad things from happening. So we have a lot of preventive controls. We also have services in our stack that are for situational awareness. We call them the detective-type controls. Then we also have services in our stack that recognize the brutal reality that we face today, that bad things are going to happen, and we're going to have to be able to respond to them quickly and recover from those scenarios. So looking at security from a privacy perspective, there's certain things that are obvious. When we have private data, we have to have access controls in place, and we have to constantly review access controls and have automated ways that enforce the concept of least privilege, that only people that need access to data should have access to data. And that's what falls within the access control domain. We have other controls in place as well. We have multiple kinds of boundary defenses that are in place. I think people think of traditional firewalls that are in place, but there's also other kinds of border defense technologies that we deploy as well. We do services such as vulnerability management. One of the things that I know from years of experience working in cybersecurity is that most of the bad things that happen today in the security space exploit vulnerabilities in our systems that haven't been properly remediated. So every day within Minute Services, we scan upwards of 30,000 devices with automated solutions in attempt to find and fix our own problems before other people find and fix them for us by exploiting those vulnerabilities. Those are a few examples of technical types of tools that are in our disposal to set that security framework that privacy depends on. But there's also a lot of non-technical things that happen as well. Earlier I heard conversations about secure configurations, you know, really simple stuff like that, making sure that we have a policy and standard foundation so we clearly articulate what configuration standards are we going to be using for our gear. We subscribe to the Center for Internet Security, and we start our configuration baselines with a nationally recognized framework. They're called the CIS benchmarks. We also have non-technical controls in place that are also important when it comes to privacy, and that's just general employee training and awareness, making sure that employees understand that they are a target. And the easiest way to exploit a system is to exploit an employee and get an employee to do something that they should not do with our systems and our data. So we have multiple security awareness programs that are in place. Some of those programs are targeted for agencies that have specific compliance needs that have a privacy slant to them. So, for example, the Minnesota Department of Revenue has a customized training program that not only talks about security and privacy concepts, but it targets them towards their primary regulatory framework, which is IRS 1075. We have similar requirements that are in play in the healthcare space, where there's a lot of compliance requirements that relate to HIPAA. And then finally, for the broader state employees, we use a program that's tailored for us by one of the leading security vendors in the world. It's called the SANS organization, and the vast majority of employees get more of the generic program that we call Securing the Human. So these are a few examples of some of the things that need to take place in a security program. It's a big topic, as Representative Lucero pointed out. You could have multiple meetings to talk about any one of the areas within here. I think the key takeaway, though, is that our program is designed to have prevention, detection, and corrective capabilities all built in one thoughtful framework. Moving on quickly, if I would look at privacy and I'd say, well, what is the biggest opportunity on the horizon? What I would say is that we need to do a better job going forward of baking privacy considerations into our systems when they're built. It's very much like building a house, that if we go and we build a house and we forget to put plumbings and bathroom in the house, it's really, really hard after the fact to retrofit a house and to put in some of those things that we probably should have thought about at the onset when it was a lot more cost-effective to do so. But we have an opportunity, especially with new system design, to get security right, and that's something that we're focusing on with our secure engineering team, but also to get privacy right as well. And if you look at any of the nationally recognized privacy frameworks that are out there, there's three that I've referred to in the past. The AICPA has one called Generally Accepted Privacy Principles. The Department of Commerce has one with their Safe Harbor Principles, and then also one that I've referred to in the past is the OECD Privacy Principles. When you look at the collection of principles, they're principles that aren't necessarily all IT-related, but some of them are highly IT-related, and in the principles in all of the frameworks, having a strong cybersecurity program is foundational to all of the frameworks. But then there's some other things that are tangential as well. So, for example, when we talk about use limitation for data, I believe that can't take place unless you really understand the classifications of the data and you actually put the access controls around the data the way they need to be put around during the design of solutions. And also, one of the things that we also need to be cognizant of when you're talking about privacy and having transparency so that people can go in after the fact and determine what happened to their particular data, it's extremely difficult to do unless you think about up front what are the logging and data retention requirements that are going to be necessary in order to make that functionality happen. Because, unfortunately, most systems don't come out of the box with all those type of capabilities. As Representative Lucero pointed out, operating systems and low-level parts of the IT stack have a lot of those capabilities. But when you're talking about applications that do specific functions, that's where it gets a little bit dicier, where applications aren't always developed. They're developed to do a function, but they're not always developed to record who did it, why they did it, and get that transactional history. So those are some of the things we need to think about during system design. As far as responsibilities go, one of the things that I try to point out is even though I'm the state's chief security officer, I don't consider myself to own security risk. When it comes to security risk and it comes to privacy, I really think that risk is owned by the agencies themselves. So agencies ultimately own that risk. And the role of MNIT in these decisions is to help the leaders of those organizations really understand what is the risk posture, what are the options that are available to help them meet the business objectives, and then to help them with ongoing risk assessments, because solutions change over time, the needs change, and to help them, you know, keep abreast of what's going on with ongoing risk management. So, Madam Chair, committee members, that's kind of my high-level overview of security, the relationship between security and privacy. And I'd be more than happy to take any questions or to have any takeaways for you. So thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. My question relates to, first of all, I understand a lot of what you said, some of those terms, but I got the gist of it. And I'm wondering, all the things that we have to do in order to maintain security. So in my military job, I got to go through these goofy modules every year to maintain my security clearance about don't take a unsecure drive to or a secure drive to an unsecure area. We keep specific demarcations between secret clearance machines, hard drives, and non-secure, all that stuff, which can be taught to everyone how to do that. I understand that. But it strikes me that if you've got organizations like Target or Ashley Madison, Target, whose commercial reputation is besmirched, and they went after that for the hackers went after it for monetary value, but Ashley Madison, for whom the hackers, there wasn't even a monetary motivation at all. If organizations like those whose reputation is based upon their security can't even protect themselves and the resources they have to ensure security of their data is central to, you know, what they're pitching. They have a lot more resources than we do, and they can't do it. Part of me feels like, is there really a point here? Can we really do this? Is it just a matter of time, and is it inevitable? Or is what you're talking about, are we simply trying to reduce the risk so that it happens less frequently?
Mr. Buzzi.
Madam Chairs, committee members, I think a key takeaway from that message is it's not a lost cause. You know, we owe it to the citizens to make sure that we protect our systems and data and that we have a robust and comprehensive security program, you know, to achieve those security objectives. So that's what we need to do as a government. The fact that large organizations like Target and the list goes on, have had major security breaches, even though they throw a lot of resources at us, should all make us realize that we really have to think long and hard about what we're doing and how we're going to structure information security across state government. And for that reason, information security is Commissioner Baden's number one priority. It's not app development. The number one priority we have as an agency right now is focusing on information security. I just got out of an executive retreat, and we had our lead IT professionals that sit in our agencies as well as in our central functions, and we all are having strategic conversations about what are we going to do collectively to help manage this risk the best that it possibly can be.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Representative Lesh's point, it's not necessarily the best metric to look at these organizations. Granted, they have millions or billions of dollars of resources, but one of the common threads throughout the information security industry is that we are struggling to get budgets, right? Every year there's the annual budget, and marketing gets their budget, and operations gets their budget, et cetera. Then IT security comes, and you'd be shocked
how difficult it is and how much effort has to go into us and our justifications to get dollars for what we want to do in advance. And so I think, you know, 1% of the, if you take the entire budget, 1% typically going to information security is considered a victory for us. And so when you look at Target, then, as an example, while they do have a lot of money, they also have a lot of surface area, a lot of exposure to have to try and protect. And I think the one breach here that happened a couple years back was actually they go after malicious parties go after the weakest link. And in this case, the weakest link was a supplier, if I recall. So they went to a supplier of which the – I don't know what they were supplying to Target, but they had less security apparently, but they have networked systems. So once they compromised somebody outside of Target, a supplier, through the network, they're able to move upstream. So using large employers with large budgets being compromised as a metric isn't necessarily the best, I guess is all the point that I wanted to bring, because it's definitely worthy of the effort. And we can do it. It's just a matter of putting the right resources and the right people at it. So,
well, and Madam Chair, this then brings to light the question that we get from agencies that come in here all the time when they request to share data. Because if we're sharing data with agencies that don't have the same protections as Minute or DHS or something else, then it does the same thing that happened to the Target supplier, which we ought to be keeping in mind, and I don't think has ever been brought up when agencies are talking to each other. Primarily, I think law enforcement, we hear law enforcement wanting to share data with each other, and I think that should be an important question that comes up next time we talk about pooling these systems.
And Representative Lesch, this conversation is reminding me of, well, Mr. Busy, what you mentioned, that Minute helps agency management, but the agency management actually owns the risk. And the interaction between, okay, there are benefits of the centralization within Minute, obviously, but then you spread that out over agencies, and then you spread that out over all our counties and different local government units and different levels of hardware, software, and the abilities there. And so I don't know that we're necessarily going to be able to get to the bottom of this today, but I think it is a sort of a big picture question about how all these entities interact with software and hardware and every and the human part of it, and how do we ever feel confident that within all those connections there aren't loose or broken links somewhere. I don't know if you want to comment briefly on that, but that might be a conversation for another time in greater depth.
Madam Chair, committee members, in the role as the Chief Security Officer for the state of Minnesota, my jurisdiction effectively covers the executive branch of state government. And so we're putting in our program to make sure that we can figure out a way to address weak links across the entire executive branch. You know, security from a funding perspective, you know, we spend approximately 2% of our IT budget on security. We certainly know that we don't have unlimited resources at our disposal, but that's something that we need to change long term, you know, to become more in line with organizations that have a risk posture like ours today. But I also get an opportunity to speak at least a couple times a year and work with cities and counties. And the problems that we face with the executive branch are compounded when you get down to the local government level. And Representative Lucero was spot on when he talks about the resource limitations that when you get down to that level, it becomes very problematic. We try to help them when we can. We monitor some of their traffic. We have a program that we've initiated to extend our monitoring solutions out to Minnesota counties, and that's working collectively with the Division of Homeland Security and the Public Safety Department, where we're putting in intrusion detection systems and new advanced firewalls out in counties using federal grant dollars, and we help monitor the devices for them. So to the extent that we can, we're trying to figure out ways to leverage our position, but we're still at a point where we're trying to definitely take the bar up in the executive branch, but we also recognize that all of our partners in government have problems as well, and we're trying to work with them to the best of our ability.
Senator Zippel.
Thank you. What triggers this question is the discussion about how much easier it is to build these security features in as software is being developed and deployed versus retroactively trying to go back and build some functionality into the legacy systems that we have around the state and state being used by state agencies. My question is, just do we have a general sense? I mean, this may be an impossible question to answer, but I mean, do we have? Well, maybe it's not. Now we have a minute. You know, it's supposed to be the kind of the big overarching umbrella support and owner of technology across the entire enterprise. So how much is out there in the way of these old legacy systems, these old mainframe 30, 40-year-old systems that we're using for various services and functions, and is there a systematic plan to update those? And how big is this? I mean, we know, of course, about Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions. We just toured the labs and heard about the new systems, criminal record system and an investigation system and all of those, and we've already mentioned Minlars. What else is out there?
Mr.
Or how much?
Madam Chair, committee members, that's a question that I think we could probably come back and talk about after doing, you know, a comprehensive analysis. Getting a question like that, the best I can do at this point is tell you that when you look at all the different functions of government, from managing the roads, to healthcare, to education, to prisons, there's legacy technology everywhere. So it's scattered throughout all the government agencies. That's one of the challenges that you face as a security professional, is that a lot of the legacy technology can't be patched properly. There's issues with the software when you start to deal with legacy. And they also have a trickle-down effect as well if there's, you know, a legacy application that may or may not be supported anymore that runs an organization. It probably doesn't run on the latest computer operating systems either, so there's trickle-down effects, you know, throughout the organization. One thing that I would like to point out, though, is that there are some good plans in place, you know, to address a lot of these issues more holistically. They're not things that are going to happen overnight, but when people ask me, well, what's the number one thing you can do to be more secure, I always tell them it's to change IT. And, you know, we're coming from a world where we had, you know, upwards of 70-plus silos of small IT organizations that ran all over the place. And what we're looking now in the new Minute Vision is to really put in place more managed hosting environments. So in the past, organizations couldn't afford sophisticated vulnerability management and sophisticated monitoring. They couldn't afford the tools or the people to do these kind of things. But collectively, when you look at our economy of scale as an executive branch of state government, when we build a hosting environment to house all 6,000-plus servers that we're going to have, we certainly can have an environment that has all of those types of security features built in from the onset. So I think the agenda that was laid out for Minute, you know, by the bipartisan legislation that was enacted several years ago, I think it sets the stage for our agency to run better and more secure IT. And I think probably one of the biggest wins that we'll see is the ability to securely host.
So,
Senator DeLevo.
Madam Chair, I don't want to create a big project for this committee. I assume Minute is doing some sort of enterprise-wide assessment and analysis and inventory of everything that's out there. That's got to be happening. So I would be interested in receiving that.
Okay.
Kind of how big is this and how much is out there? Information.
Mr. Boozy.
Madam Chairs, committee members, understanding the hardware, the software, and the network device inventory is one of the issues that we're working on right now. There's some areas that we have a very good understanding of what's going on, and there's some of the areas and some of the agency offices that operated very autonomously where we're still working on that, but efforts are being made both on the inventory perspective, on project management, lots of different areas, transforming Minute into an organization that truly is an enterprise IT provider. And that's just one of the elements.
Thank you.
Any additional questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Busy, for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Information. All right, and going back to the agenda, the next topic is the overview discussion of the minimum baseline protection standards for state agencies. I know, Representative Lucero, you had talked about this initially. Is there additional discussion on this topic?
Madam Chair, I'm just Scott? Wondering, you know, I don't know how you go about finding out, you know, what cities and local units of government are using to secure the data within their entities, I guess they're within their systems, but it seems like this probably needs to be explored a little bit further, and I don't know if there's some sort of online survey that we could send some of them to see. You know, are your folks changing their passwords every 90 days? You know, Representative Lucero would know, I guess, the questions to ask, and maybe we could help formulate that, but I think it deserves more discussion than just saying, hey, this might be an issue out there. I think we need to take some further action on it, because this is the citizens, this is our constituents' mm-hmm. private information that we're talking about, and I think we have a duty to make it
secure. Absolutely. Well, and Representative Lucero, you know, from when we were initially talking about topics that we as a body want to discuss, my understanding is that that's pretty much what you were referring to and outlining. So, you know, I think we've put down the marker that this is something that is going to need additional attention. So, Representative Lucero, you want to comment further?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And then just to add on these comments and my previous comments, having a minimum baseline that is to be followed, and then it's discretionary what different agencies or in this case local units government want to do above that. To compare that to what happens in the private sector, there are the main drivers I should say regulatory compliance are Sarbanes-Oxley requirements for IT systems, GLBA, which is Graham-Leach-Bliley Act for financial institutions. HIPAA and high tech, we typically hear of HIPAA many times, but HIPAA and high tech are drivers, and they have requirements for IT systems. Now, those are all regulatory compliance mandated by government. But then there's another one that's grown as a result of industry, and it's called PCI. It's the payment card industry, and it's a very good standard. And it has those IT systems that are in scope and are required to adhere to the PCI standards are systems that either store, transmit, or process credit card data. And so if you're, it doesn't matter what organization you are, if your systems have those, one of those three, you would have to adhere to it. And then so that's the driver, and that's what motivates. Then internal organizations, they put budgets together, they put architectures together, which then leads to numbers and then budgets to be able to secure their systems. So using that as an analogy to government and local units of government, should we have that, and that's why I have that bullet point there, should there be a baseline standard similar to PCI, for example, modeled after that, that here, local units of government, here's the baseline that you have to adhere to. Now, while payment card or credit cards may not be the driver, I don't know if local units of government are storing credit cards or if they're storing Social Security numbers. I have no idea. But there's another piece of data that I think is very important that we be cognizant of, and that is when you take information that's being collected from different areas of private citizens' lives, and I don't know to what degree at the local level, but whatever degree they are, if they're collecting this different information, data warehousing and big data is a concept out there of taking these different pieces of information, correlating them together, and creating brand new data from those correlated patterns. And that can be very personal data about where people have been, what they do, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And to have a baseline of standards
that protects that type of data, I think is definitely worthy of discussion. And then I did, I have a copy. So when it comes to law enforcement now at local units of government, the FBI has a standard. It's a very good standard. I actually showed it on the House floor when we were talking about the LPR thing. Then there's a requirement in there for law enforcement agencies at the local level that, and so that comes down to, so from the FBI's perspective, the local level is the state. So the state at our level is the BCA. They are the ones in charge of creating an information security policy, and they have, it's a much thinner one. Then that delegates responsibility down to the individual law enforcement agencies at the county and city level of what they have to adhere to for configurations at their level. But now that only applies to, if you have a city hall, that's applying to just the law enforcement. It's not applying to everything else. So that would be, again, an example where I think a baseline may be something that we should consider.
Thank you, Mr. Lucero. Any additional comments on, so for the agenda, I'm trying to correlate back to the agenda. So that was sort of 6 and 7 both combined. Have we addressed those together? Okay. All right. Members, any other discussion on these subjects at this time? All right. And so, yes, these will be factored into the topics that we will be considering that we want to address as we move forward. With that, I would like to invite additional testimony from members of the audience on any of the topics that we've been discussing so far. Mr. Neumeister, good to see you.
Madam Chair, members of the Privacy Data Practices Commission, I would like to share with you two ideas that I would like to suggest that you entertain over the next few months as you come up with your topics. First of all, you might have been reading a lot about emails nationally and also locally, where they're being destroyed, they're on private servers, people are looking for information because you find out a lot of things. The public does, the news media does. And what we have here in Minnesota is where it's all over the board. St. Paul, their responsible authority is here, Sherry Moore. Recently, they have a policy where they basically destroy emails very quickly, also with attachments to them. Depending on how people are trained or whatever, a lot of things are being destroyed which were available for the public to inspect and review and to find out about issues or whatever. They basically kept a lot of their emails for up to 3 years. There's a lot of news media about that. It's something you can have someone dig into more about. So the basic issue is that the state needs to address, like other states have done, broad retention schedules or standards for that kind of information. Because what's happening, and historically, Mr. Gimberling and other folks can tell you, we used to have a state records management policy. And then because there was no money for it, that statute was decimated, gone, bye-bye. Now everyone is on their own, and now we have what the retention schedule made up, someone from the AG's office or whatever. The city makes an application, and then things are, whatever they decide, that's what it is. So all I'm saying is that what a number of other states are starting to do legislatively, you keep emails for 2 years. You do it for 4 years, 6 years, or whatever. Because what's happening, all the documents are no longer on paper. And so I just share that with you a little bit to maybe dig more into it. There's a lot of things about it. The other thing is that I've had the opportunity over the last year to meet with hundreds of the public, members, people like me, residents, citizens, who are learning how to do the Data Practices Act and who do use it. It's because through the Sunlight Foundation and Public Records Media, who sponsored, we've been doing free workshops. And one of the things that we're starting to see, and other folks can tell you, but more so you really see it with the citizens, is on when they want to inspect government data. What's beginning to happen now is a large amount of government data is in an electronic file. It's in a PDF. So what's been happening, and it's documented with some of the people I've talked to and even my own experience, is the government employee, when you're asking for a file or for information, maybe it could take only maybe a minute and 37 seconds, send it to your email. But what's been happening, they're making all paper copies and then having a person come in to view it. And there are some scenarios where that's been the case. A great many cities, though, are also going to the point it's easier for under the realm of inspection, if it's already an electronic file or a PDF, just send it to you, because then you don't have to have a person come in and watch or whatever. I'll give you two examples. I asked for some inactive criminal investigations at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension on the issue of the stingray several years ago. Now, whether or not they were electronic file or not, I have no idea. But I looked at a great number of the pages, but they also had someone who was probably making $20 plus for about 6 to 8 hours as I was reviewing those over a couple of days, watching me, because they had it on a computer. Now, whether that was on a file or not already, and they could have just sent it to me, I do not know. But I am aware of a person you may have heard about, Tony Webster, who's been involved with the issue of Bloomington and getting things. And from my own experience, that some cities have just said, yeah, it's all electronically. Here, just take it. And so it saves things. We have to take a look in this new world that if it's already there and all that, why is government putting it on paper? And here's 600 pages to review. And then also at the same time, while you're reviewing it, this is a situation up in Duluth, they had also a person watch. So government was paying for the, just was already an electronic file, made the paper copy. And then as they were reviewing and inspecting the paper copy, there was someone sitting there for 6-8 hours on some stuff. So I think that's another area. One of the suggestions, and it's, you can always toy with language, is whatever maximizes inspection, that could be some language, whatever maximizes inspection, that's what goes to the requester. Because that has always been, for a great number of decades, you can inspect for free. My experience has been, over the hundreds of requests I've been doing over the last 5-6 years, is I'm getting a lot of stuff electronically. And people are saying, hey, Rich, you know, we already have electronic. And I get sometimes 500 pages because it's already in the file, rather than me come in and rather than inconvenience them. So I think, and some cities believe the law does not allow for them to do that. It does, though. And a great many cities are starting to interpret the law in that regard. So those are the two general areas. One is, you know, let's get some standards for records management, particularly with electronic records. And then number two, the issue of to maximize inspection when there's electronic files. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Additional, Mr. Gamberling. Welcome to the commission.
Yeah, my name is Don Gemberling. Some of you know that when I show up here, I really come for two different purposes. Number one, I'm an advocate for transparency through my work with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. But I'm also a role that when I finally realized I had it, I thought, God, how did I get here? And that's institutional memory. Okay. Now, particularly for the latter role, I want to encourage any and all of you to feel free to call me, ask me, how do we get to where we got? And part of why I'm thinking in that particular mode right now is the discussion you just had about security and privacy. Okay. That discussion has been going on in this state since 1970, at least. Okay? And part of my history is I kept moving from organization to organization, and I spent about 15 years working in the computer part of state government. At one time, I was the state's chief security officer, a role that I found very strange to have. So, but what I learned from that is you can talk about enforcing standards and setting standards, and that's a discussion that was had over and over and over. But unless you have a way of enforcing them, you're not going to achieve the results you want. Okay? In part because organizations and state government change all the time. You are on about your 14th iteration of how to do data processing in the state of Minnesota. Okay? And I spent a lot of time in my historical past talking to the IT types and saying, you know, when you design things, that's the best time to build in the requirements of the Data Practices Act. Okay? Including things like access by data subjects, and including things like access by the public to data in a reasonable and easy fashion. But unless you give somebody the authority somewhere to enforce those kind of things, it's not going to happen. Okay? Give you one ancient example. In the beginning, back when I was in an IT position and in a data privacy position, I had a boss who had strong feelings about both. He built, and at that time, data processing was totally managed by the State Department of Administration. He built into all reviews of any system being developed by any state agency compliance with the Data Practices Act. I got to go through a checklist and get a lot of documentation from government agencies as to how they were going to comply with the Data Practices Act. And I got to tell you that part of my checklist activities was listening to agencies complain about that. Well, at some point that guy lost his job. I will tell you the politics. It was all about politics. And I remember having a call from a major state agency, one of the biggest, saying to me, does this mean we don't have to do those standards anymore? And I said, well, you know, you ought to be doing them because it's the right thing to do. And the guy said, well, you know, they're a bunch of crap as far as we're concerned. And that's the language he used. And we're not going to do it anymore. Okay? So for the next 30 years, that agency found itself in a variety of dilemmas about compliance with the Data Practices Act. Okay? So don't lose sight in what you're doing. Don't get bogged down in minutiae of how do you achieve compliance. Representative Lesh raised some very interesting questions. Representative Lucero commented very, you know, from a knowledge base. But part of how you get compliance from people is you make non-compliance very expensive. You want to know why a lot of organizations don't invest in IT security the way they ought to? It's because the risk factors, they don't spend the money, okay? If you were part of the target data breach, how do you get compensation from the class action suit? You have to prove that you were financially injured. Okay? Now, you can go off and sue Target if you want to for some other form of injury. I will give you a personal example. For one of the few times in my life, I used a credit card at Target because I bought a big Christmas present for one of my grandkids. And it was in that week of openness where they were vulnerable. So, maybe 3 weeks later, I'm out to dinner with friends. And my credit card is refused because it's been canceled. Okay? Now, my friends know I'm an honest, reputable human being, but, you know, for a short period of time, I suffered a certain amount of personal embarrassment, which could have been public humiliation. I can't, unless I'm crazy, and I'm not, sue Target to try and gain compensation for that. So until you come up with mechanisms to ensure compliance and mechanisms to make people invest because the risk of not investing is greater than what happens, you're not going to get the kinds of things that you want to achieve. So in both my roles, feel free to call on me, okay? I have this strange memory, my friends tell me. Some of my friends, particularly from high school, want to tell me that the things I remember about them I all made up. So, but for some reason, I'm blessed with a very long and detailed memory. I'm spending a certain amount of time now trying to dump that memory into a book, and whether or not that's ever going to get done is a different question. But in the meantime, feel free to call on me, okay? If I don't remember some, I usually don't make it up. So, okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gambler. Additional input from members of the audience? Senator Dibb. Oh, sorry.
While he approaches, yes. Something that kind of occurs to me out of the blue, but it has come up a couple of times in my work here as a senator, and that is we get really focused on electronic data, but there are a lot of paper records around, and I think actually Mr. Neumeister might have reminded me of that a little bit as well. And that poses a whole set of security issues as well. I mean, that's data. Data that we want in the right circumstances to be accessible, and in other circumstances we want to be secure. And so I just put that out there as something to think about and talk about as we start down this path of topics. I can cite a couple of instances where I myself, walking through state agencies, saw piles of paper that people shouldn't be seeing laying around on tables. It was addressed, and other instances where I was aware of that happening, and they developed a fairly secure filing cabinet system with a punch-in feature, so everyone knew who was accessing the file cabinet, that sort of thing.
Good point. I'm noted. Thank you. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Curtis Hanna. I just had a couple of issues to bring up today. I often do data requests. Rich Neumeister, who spoke before, has been kind enough to kind of mentor me a bit about how to do these things. And a couple of issues have popped up that I just wanted to bring to your attention. The first of which is Section 13605. It is related to information that's discussed by the administrative branch about policies or legislative ideas. And I was told by a couple different branches that information, including emails that relate to policy issues that are being discussed at the legislature, are forever private data. That is something that the citizens of Minnesota cannot request and inspect. And I believe that that's an issue that should be talked about and discussed by this commission, and it just should be something that is brought to your attention, I believe. Secondly, Mr. Neumeister was speaking about the email situation. There was a report that was done by CBS about Governor Dayton's office Governor Dayton himself using an AOL account for his emails. And a couple of months prior to that report, I had done a data request with the governor's office asking for his office's email retention policy, because I felt that there were certain things that I had requested about certain policy issues that I got a very small amount of data back from. And his data retention policy is actually, when I got it, I was very confused, because at the top it says Governor Jesse Ventura's data retention policy. It's actually from 2002. I believe it references electronic mail. And under that section, it actually doesn't have the rules listed of as far as how to dispose of it or how long to retain it. And even in the article itself, the CBS article, they said, or they quoted the governor's office, and it said that they have a delete or retain policy, which I believe simply comes down to the fact that they can delete it if they determine that it does not have records of official transactions in it. And so I just want to bring those things to your attention. I believe as a citizen that we ought to be able to inspect emails of the administrative branch, even if it is emails about a legislative policy that's either pending or a policy that happened and was already passed into law 3 years ago. I think that those sort of types of data should not be withheld. And lastly, I'd like to bring to your attention, and I was going to reveal this or send an email to the Office of Medical Cannabis today, but I have filed to be a caregiver, and I found that there's some issues with the database where my information is not behind a login, so my driver's license can be accessed without a login, and it, I believe, would be fairly easy to access probably everyone's information. I think only the caregivers that have applied have their driver's license available, but the patients themselves have their names available without logins, and that was something that concerned me, and I'm available to answer any sort of questions about any of this, either now or after the committee meeting today.
Representative Lesch.
So Mr. Hanna's comments bring to mind a question that I think is uniquely in the purview of this commission. By the way, nice beard, Mr. Hanna.
Thank you.
I didn't even recognize you.
I was thinking of shaving it off this morning because I was coming here.
No, don't shave it. I can't grow one like that. It's just a little thin over here. So that's outstanding.
I appreciate it.
And I know St. Paul's here too, and I was just talking with Mr. Neumeister out in the hallway too about St. Paul's new email policy, and I honestly don't know a lot about it other than I got an email saying, yeah, we used to keep emails forever, and now we keep them not forever, or something like that. I mean, I'm sure that's not what it said, but this was probably 10 years ago, early on when I was back in the city attorney's office. And my question is this. I think there's sort of a feeling for people that are adjusting to new technology, that because we can keep some data forever, we should keep the data forever. And I'm a little bit agnostic about this because I like being able to know what government's doing, yet at the same time, I'm recognizing the expense that goes along with that. And I'm seeing this a little bit with the request for an exemption from police departments. They're, you know, maybe their eyes got a little bit bigger than their stomach on the body cam things, and they're realizing, well, I guess maybe we can't afford to keep all this data. And then 3 years from now, you can't just suddenly shut that down if you're storing all the data. Then that looks weird. So I think that at some point this commission really ought to have a conversation because 30, 40 years ago, when there was all these paper records, maybe far fewer paper records, there certainly wasn't an assumption that we should keep all of that. But it's just so much easier to keep it now that I really honestly think that we should come to some kind of consensus. And there's going to be a difference of opinion about that, about the philosophical direction of it exists digitally. Does that mean it needs to exist digitally forever? And the attendant costs are shifting rapidly. The cost to maintain that data for 30 years now is going to be very different than it is the cost to maintain that data 30 years from now. I'm assuming based on Hoos Law, the size of the chip, size of the chips double every 10 years or something. You know. Moore's Law, whatever. Based on that, the cost is going to decrease, but I don't know that. So I really think that that's kind of at the crux of where we're falling here. We see it with the request from the body cam collection of data, because those are huge files, of course, and we see it with more and more types of technology. So I honestly don't have my head wrapped around that, the cost factor. So I think to add to your list, Madam Chair, but I think that's something that it would be good for us to understand as commission.
Point taken, and it is our list. Let's be clear. Team effort.
Madam Chair, could I add one more
yes,
item? One other concern that I have is that when local law enforcement agencies are using third parties to store the data for body cams, automatic license plate readers, what have you, there is a mechanism at the federal government called national security letters in which a gagged order can be given to these third-party companies requiring them to hand over that information. It's very similar to administrative subpoenas that are executed by county attorneys in Minnesota and also the Attorney General of Minnesota, which also very much concerns me. But third-party data, even potentially if it's a third party that's acting on behalf of a state agency or a local law enforcement agency, they very well could get a national security letter from the FBI and be required to hand over that information. I believe that there's been 300,000 national security letters that have been handed out since 9/11, and the first gag order has been reversed, and so we will get some information in late November related to what type of data is being collected, but I just wanted to also bring that to your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional comments or questions, members? Yes, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hanna is still in the room. I just would invite him. I'm sure, I'm guessing he'll be at the Medical Cannabis Task Force meeting next week, and would invite him to come forward during the public testimony to talk about this system security issue. Thanks.
Yes, thank you.
And also echo the beard. Right, it's a righteous beard.
All right, any additional questions or comments or input from the audience? All right, seeing none. So at this point, we will be in touch. We'll talk about scheduling future meetings. We'll talk about how we're going to prioritize and organize topics and discussions. Be in touch. Any additional thoughts you want to add to our list, feel free. And we will follow up. Anything else, members, before we adjourn? Well, I just want to thank everybody and look forward to a productive next few months. Thank you.
Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.